طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning. This is John Roberts, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative and Palestinian voice so rarely featured in the mainstream media. Recently, Palestinian professor Mazen Kumsaya visited the Boston area on a speaking tour. This Week in Palestine recorded his presentation at Boston College and will feature it over two broadcasts because of its length. Mazen Kumsaya is a Palestinian biologist and geneticist who taught at both Duke and Yale universities, but is now back in Palestine teaching at Bethlehem and Be'er Zeit universities in the West Bank. He also has founded a natural history museum in Bethlehem, where he is doing interesting and vital work with students and volunteers. That aspect of his work we will feature in a future broadcast. He is also an author and activist, and it is these aspects of his work that form the basis of our broadcast today. Because of its length, we get right to it. Here is Professor Mazen Kumsaya speaking at Boston College.
Thanks for coming, especially on a nice Sunday when you should be out doing some other things. I am actually not going to be very coherent because I have slept only like 5 hours. I got up very early this morning to go to the airport in Washington, D.C., and also I came just the night before to a conference yesterday in Washington, the Holy Land Ecumenical Christian Foundation Conference. And so I didn't sleep on the flight over from Amman, Paris, Washington, and then now Washington, Boston. And also at every step of this trip, multiple stops, I was selected for extra screening, patting down, checking everything. My boarding passes have the triple S, quadruple S, four S's on it. For extra risk security. I don't know why. I haven't, to my knowledge, I have not done anything illegal in the U.S. I did do things against Israeli law, but that's because they were unjust laws. And so, for example, I do go into Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem is off limits to us Palestinians. I smuggle myself in, literally, because we are told I cannot enter Jerusalem. I, as a Palestinian Christian who was born there, and I was a high school teacher even in Jerusalem, I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, which is only like 4 miles from the museum where I work, and I'm not allowed to enter there. Even, by the way, with my American passport, I'm not allowed to enter Jerusalem. Whereas any Jew in the world or convert to Judaism not only can come to Jerusalem, they can get automatic citizenship, settle in Jerusalem on stolen Palestinian land, and can freely move anywhere they want to. But that's the nature of what we face. Now, I don't know how much you want to know about what subjects, so I'm going to just run through my usual slides that I kind of give to talks in various places, and then see what your interests are in question and answer session. We can discuss whatever subject, as mentioned, environment, politics, the global warming that we're facing, all this stuff, because it's really, I say we're facing as humanity a lot of challenges. But as humans, it's an existential struggle for us, and we definitely can solve these challenges if we put our act together, if we don't listen to the politicians, in my humble opinion, who are always after money and after power, and they really don't care what the common people want. And I'm talking about all politicians, yes, including Palestinian politicians, unfortunately. It was mentioned that I wrote two books. One is about sharing the land of Canaan, one about popular resistance in Palestine. They're available in many languages. Those of you who are students and want to have access to the books, just let me know. I'm happy to share them with you. Sharing the Land of Canaan actually is on my website, and the other one is still, they prevent me from putting it on my website, but if you want, I could send you PDF of it. I don't care. I don't believe in copyright and money and all that stuff. But I think we have to realize that first we have to be humble to realize that we are nothing compared to this universe that's out there. You know, Earth is just this small planet, but it's all we have, and it's a fragile planet, actually. It's a planet that supports life, and it's the only one that we know of so far that supports life. And we in Palestine, of course, are a very small, tiny part of this planet. It's a special place in some sense because of its history, but no more and no less. We Palestinians and the people or Jews or whoever lives there are certainly nothing special. We're just human beings like everybody else. But we have kind of a unique history. And this unique history includes the fact that this is the Fertile Crescent, or at least part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first went from hunter-gatherer to agriculture. This is where, of course, when you go from hunter-gatherer to agriculture, you have more time on your hand, so you also start inventing things like civilization. And quote-unquote, you know. And the reason for that is an accident of geography, by the way. An accident of geography and geology, that this is a rich part of the world in terms of the topography and the landscape, and there's a lot of wild plants and animals there. Biodiversity is very high for a mild climate latitude, if you want, compared to other parts that are on the same latitude as we are. We're also unique in being at the center connection between Europe, Asia, and Africa. That pivot, if you want. And because of that, also, it's kind of unique. For example, in migration of birds, there are over 500 million birds that pass through Palestine on annual migration from Europe to North Africa, to Africa, basically. And as I said, as we humans in Palestine, in Syria and in Iraq, in this part, what's now called Palestine, Syria, and Iraq, this Fertile Crescent, we developed agriculture like domesticated wheat and barley and lentils and chickpeas. You know, chickpeas make hummus and things like that. And also domesticated animals like goats and donkeys and so forth. And started to have more time on our hand, because when you're a hunter-gatherer, you have to catch your food and or collect it daily. Very hard work. But when you are an agricultural community, you have time. So you develop methods of doing things and housing and clothing and alphabet. For example, the alphabet that you use here actually comes from our part of the world. I don't know if you know why the A is shaped like this. It's from Aleph, which is the bull in Aramaic with the two horns. The B is from Beit, because it's a line, half circle. Beit is a house. So when you turn it sideways, you get the B. That's in Latin or English. That's where it came from. It comes from our part of the world. Now, this part of the world has one of the oldest, by the way, continuously inhabited town on earth, which is Jericho. Over 10,000 years of civilization, if you want. I say, you know, jokingly civilization, because I think humans have a long way to be civilized, but that's another story. There is conflict, of course, in this part of the world, and conflict that creates a lot of injustice. And I was thinking, I was actually telling Rains in the car how I feel the injustice of me being searched and so forth. But I told the TSA people, Homeland Security people, that at least you didn't shoot me. And And that's okay, you know. It's still a minor injustice that you are selecting me for no reason, just because I write and lecture about Palestine and because Israel told you to select me. I'm going to challenge it, by the way. I'm going to go after them with the Freedom of Information Act and try to find out, to try to prevent them from doing this more and more to me. But I said to him, you know, look, you know, there are people that are subjected to far worse injustice. And I told Reins in the car that just yesterday, three Palestinians were killed, young people. And that makes the number of Palestinians killed over 40 since the beginning of this month, including 10 children. And the people who were killed yesterday, the three people who were killed, one of them tried to stab a soldier. And that's evident that he tried to stab a soldier. Actually, there's a picture of a soldier with a machine gun running away from him with the guy with the knife, which is kind of amazing. But two soldiers actually ran away from him, and then they shot him. But the other two were innocent bystanders who had nothing to do. One of them was a girl, 16 years old. And clearly she was not carrying any knife or object or anything else. I just shot her because she is Palestinian. The other guy, there's even the video of it, ironically, which shows that a settler shot him, an Israeli settler, shot this guy in Hebron. And then the soldiers came after they heard the shots, three, four shots. So they came running and they saw the settler with the gun pointed at this guy on the ground. So they asked the settler to step back. And then one of the soldiers comes to the other soldier and hands him a knife. And the other soldier leans down, put the knife next to the guy to frame him that he was using a knife. This is the kind of injustice that happens on a daily basis. And I haven't watched the news today to see what actually happened today or in the past 24 hours since I've been on the flights and so forth. But there may be other things that happen. So with this injustice that's present today, this conflict that's present today, obviously nobody likes it. Nobody enjoys being in such a situation. So one wants to get rid of this illness, if you want, which is the conflict. And as a person who taught in medical schools, I tell my students, I told my students at the medical schools at Duke and Yale, that as a medical doctor, when you reach that level, what is your primary responsibility? They say treatment. I said, well, before treatment, well, diagnosis. Okay, so you have to make the right diagnosis. Because if you apply treatment with the wrong diagnosis, then it doesn't matter what treatment you apply, it is not going to work. So you have to really think about what is the real diagnosis. Why is there a problem? Why is there a conflict? Is conflict intrinsic to human nature? Is conflict biologic? Is there a gene for conflict? And as a biologist, I can tell you, no. We mapped the human genome now, and we have not found a gene that says for war or for killing or anything else. So this is all educated. And so what is this particular conflict about? And how did it come about? And what is the educational components, if you want, and this is the analytical mind of my biology training that goes about things. And when I did that, and I went to do this kind of research, if you want, and it is research. And by the way, they don't teach us at schools any of this stuff, unfortunately. Even in Palestinian schools, they don't teach real history. They teach a mythological history that's built on all sorts of notions that are not objective and not correct. So what is the real history and why is there a conflict there? Is conflict integral to the Middle East? Maybe, you know, there's Hollywood likes us to think, actually, in many movies I noticed they put this intentionally, by the way, I believe. Like, and the movie would be about a love story or about crime or anything else, totally unrelated to politics. And then, like, when they show the hero or somebody standing in front of a TV, switching news, and on the news, well, the Middle East, in the future even, like science fiction movies, 20 years, 50 years down the road, the Middle East has people killing it, as if it's going to be happening 50 years from now or 100 years from now. Or they go back to in the past and try to think that we have been killing each other for hundreds of years, as some Zionists like to say. Well, the reality is this is not true. Objectively, it's not true. I challenge you, as anybody can do this research. I tell my students, by the way, don't believe anything I say. You can always research things yourself. Go research how much of our history in Palestine and how much of the history in Europe has been a history of conflict, wars. And you will find that in Europe, actually, it's like 5 or 10 times more as a percentage of European history than in our history. And in our history, it may be 0.1% or 0.5% of our history that has been a conflict history over the past 10,000 years, for example. So we actually have a very small proportion of our history that involved active conflict, if you want. And what were these conflicts about? What is conflict about? Where does it come from? Is it because of religions, for example, which is another mythology that they try to impose on us? And now it's all over the media, you know, the Muslims this, the Islam this, that. Is it because of religion? And, you know, I'm not a very religious person. My family is Christian, by the way, but I, if you want my history, I have, my mother is Lutheran, my father is Greek Orthodox, my wife is Chinese American, her family is Buddhist. My sister went to Utah, became a Mormon. I have a cousin who converted to Islam. So on religions, I'm totally confused. But on the issue of the role of religion in conflict, I'm not confused. There was never, ever a conflict in Palestinian history that was truly because of religion. Never. You might say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Yes, and show me. I mean, what is it? Give me an example. The Crusaders, for example. Were the Crusaders about Christianity? Did Christianity teach the Crusaders to go kill Jews and Muslims and kill my ancestors who happened to be Christians of another denomination? No, it was for money, for resources, for problems in Europe. The princes were fighting each other in Europe, and the Pope said, well, instead of fighting each other, let's not get them all to go fight somebody else. So it's a way of unifying them. Whatever, you can analyze the actual reasons, but really the actual reasons were not about liberating the holy sites from the infidels, the Muslims. Actually, at the time the Crusaders came to Palestine, all the Christian holy sites in Palestine were under Christian jurisdiction. And there were actually more Christians and Jews in Jerusalem than there were Muslims in Jerusalem. This is a fact of history. At the time the Crusaders came, there were more Christians in Palestine than when the Crusaders finished their crusades, or, you know, at the height of their crusades. So it was not about Christianity or about promotion of Christianity. They came for other reasons, and usually for... I hate to make a simplified generalization, but essentially most, if not all, wars are about money. About money, about resources, about getting extra resources, getting you know, people to... So, of course, in this very long history, as I said, 10,000 years history of civilization, these conflicts, which tried to... gets the resources and the money and achieve some things, achieved part of their objective in that they did become richer or whatever. But the stated objectives they gave, for example, in the case of the Crusaders, the stated objective was to make Palestine part of Christendom, a Christian state. There was also a Muslim ruler who said, the purpose of my attacking the Christians and Jews in Palestine. This was 500-600 years ago, before the Ottomans, was to make Palestine a Muslim country. That was his stated objective, but as I said, it was not the real objective. But whatever, the stated objective even was a failure, a dismal failure. Look at the stated objective of the Crusaders to make Palestine Christendom. At the height of the Crusaders, there were more non-Christians in Palestine than there were Christians in Palestine, at the height of the Crusaders. So they failed miserably. Why did they fail? And I think this is an important lesson in history. Why do these movements fail? They fail because, as a biologist, I can tell you, efforts to make our environment dominated by one species is actually not healthy and is rejected by the ecosystem. When we look at ecosystems and we see ecosystems that are healthy, they have many species with few individuals of each different species. Ecosystems that are disturbed and bad and unhealthy will have a dominance of one species. A lot of rats or a lot of crows. Not that I have anything against rats or crows. They are very nice species. But the dominance of one or two species tells you there's something wrong with this ecosystem and it's unstable and it will not survive. And this is indeed what also, in my estimation, is also true of humanity. Any attempt to make uniformity among humans is unhealthy and unstable. Take the example of the Nazis, for example, their attempt to make the uniformity of, you know, Aryan, white, German-speaking people. It failed. So any attempt to try and make uniformity is faced with failure. And this is more true in Palestine, in my humble opinion, than anywhere else on earth. Why? Because Palestine is an ancient country, and so is a place where there is a lot of religions, a lot of cultures, a lot of languages. We have Baha'i, we have Christian, we have Druze, we have Muslim, we have Jews. You know, we have a variety of people. To try and make it uniform is, at best, a futile effort. Bound to fail. The Crusaders were bound to fail. That one Muslim ruler who tried to make it the Muslim state was bound to fail and did fail. And they never succeed. These movements never succeed. The last movement to try to do this and also did not succeed is called Zionism, which is the idea of take Palestine and make it into the Jewish state of Israel. Now, notice I use past tense, did not succeed, not future tense that will not succeed. It actually failed, miserably. And we can talk more in detail about this, but... but what is the origin of this movement and why did it come about? Well, it came about in Europe. Unfortunately, a lot of stupid ideas in the universe come out of Europe. But that's the case, you know. Because for some reason, I don't know why, we have to analyze it. One of you needs to do research on this. Why is colonialism came out of Europe, not out of Asia? Why is imperialism came out of Europe, not out of Asia? Why is Nazism came out of Europe, not out of... Why is Zionism came out of Europe? It's an interesting phenomenon, but I think it needs to be investigated. But anyways, so the Zionism came out of Europe, and it was a simple idea. It said that Jews of Europe and from other parts of the world need to go and create a Jewish state in Palestine where Jews run their own affairs, they control the country, whatever. Now, when this idea came in the mid to late 19th century, Palestine was 97% not Jewish. How are you going to take a country that's 97% not Jewish and make it the Jewish state of Israel? And the early Zionists realized this conundrum, this problem. Herzl, for example, he sent two rabbis to study Palestine in 1897. And the two rabbis were supposed to report to him in detail about the country and suitability of it being a Jewish state, etc. And the two rabbis, before they sent their report to Vienna, they sent a telegram to Vienna. And the telegram simply said, and really Herzl didn't need to read the full report because the telegram said it all. Telegram simply said, the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. It's a wonderful country for a Jewish state, but there are people here. What are we going to do with these people? Well, the answer was obvious. They had to go. So in the process, I mean, I don't want to make this a history lesson. This is colonialism. You want to remove the natives somehow. You want to separate the natives from their land, because after all, to make a Jewish state, you need the land. And the land is owned by the natives. How are you going to remove the natives from the land? You can either commit genocide, which happened, by the way, in Australia and North America, South America, of Native Americans, or you can move them out, or you can use them as slave labor, or some method to take care of the natives and separate them from their land. The Zionists chose what they called cleansing. This is their word, by the way, not my word. Cleansing means that you have to clean the land of its native people. Just like you would clean your agricultural land of thorns and stones, you want to clear the land of the native people. And so cleansing meant, and there's a book on this by Ilan Pape called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, meant that 530 villages and towns, which you see in the red dots, were wiped out, and people were made refugees. And today, 7 million of us are refugees or displaced people, living in various places like Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and also inside the state. Israel was created on 78% of the land of Palestine. And in 1967, Israel expanded to acquire the remaining 22% of Palestine. And in these processes, removing people from their land and building settlements, for example, you can see the names of the major settlements in the West Bank on the right-hand side of that map. The blue here is the settlements in the Bethlehem area around my village in Beit Sahur, around Bethlehem area where I teach at Bethlehem University. And you can see how the settlements are, and the light blue is also areas of intended expansion of the settlements on our land. From Beit Sahur, they took land from my relatives. About 30% of the land of Beit Sahur is gone because of these settlements that are to the north of Beit Sahur. Now, colonialism is never done in one fell swoop. I mean, you know that in North America, for example, the early colonies started and then they expanded westward. And the maps on the lower right side of the U.S. Actually inspired me and my son to draw the map over there on the top when he was in high school. And that map is now used everywhere. So we were the original people who created this shrinking map of Palestine. But thank you. But that came to us from this, inspired by what happened here. I mean, I hate to use the word inspired with such tragic consequences. There are, of course, differences. I mean, it's not the same situation as in North America, because even when North America was colonized and so forth, a lot of natives were killed and died because of diseases the Europeans brought, etc. In our case, there was literal ethnic cleansing to remove them into refugee camps and so forth. So a more appropriate analogy perhaps is South Africa, where the blacks were relegated to small areas called Bantustans, countries for the black people. And in South Africa, these black areas, if you want, were 11.5% of the land of South Africa. In our case, we are now reduced to 8.3% of our historic land of Palestine. On this 8.3%, in these isolated cantons or ghettos, if you want, live 6.2 million Palestinians. And in the other 91.7% of the land lives 6.1 million Israeli Jews. More than half of them are new immigrants. This picture from Radha Karmi and Ellen Siegel. Ellen, by the way, was in Boston. I don't know if she's still in Boston. She was a nurse. And this is an old picture of them in 1973, and Radha lives in London. And here they are in front of the Israeli embassy in consulate in Chicago. And, you know, the signs are self-explanatory about what the reality that we face as Palestinians, if you want. Okay, if this is what I said to you so far in this section, and is what I call the diagnosis. The diagnosis is that we have colonialism, and diagnosis and the symptoms of this can be very frustrating, you know. The injustice that I explained earlier against me and against others is frustrating sometimes. But we should not be overwhelmed with the diagnosis. You know, when doctor tells me somebody you have cancer, you know, you shouldn't just say, well, let's go jump off a roof, you know. You have to think, is there therapy for this? Is there a possibility of resolving this? And more importantly, what's a prognosis? You know, prognosis, what's the likelihood of a cure or getting better and so forth. So I think it's important to talk about diagnosis and make the right diagnosis, because as I said, if you make the wrong diagnosis, especially if you confuse one of the symptoms with the diagnosis, then you are in trouble. If you have cancer, for example, and you have, let's say, many symptoms, including skin rash, and then you say, well, that disease I have is something that a dermatologist should take care of and give me some cream and that's it. No, I'm sorry, it may make you feel better, but it is not going to be a cure. You really have to go to the etiology, as we say, or the underlying cause of this, and treat that. So the underlying cause in our situation is colonialism. And colonialism is a harsh term, it may seem, and I may seem radical sometimes when I speak. But actually, it's not so radical, because the Zionists themselves use that term. The first organization they set up to colonize Palestine, they themselves called Jewish Colonization Association. So it is not a harsh term. The word apartheid, by the way, is not such a harsh term also, because actually the Zionists themselves used it. The Israeli government says that our system is a system of Hafrada. Hafrada in Hebrew means in English segregation. And what's the word segregation in Afrikaner language? Apartheid. So it's a system of segregation, system of apartheid, system of racism, which is illustrated by this picture. If this is the diagnosis, okay, you know, the wall is a problem, the settlements are problems, the killing that's happening now, these Palestinian children, and occasionally one Israeli guy who gets stabbed and dies, this is all symptoms. They are not the underlying cause. I mean, they are important to study them and understand them, because the collection of these symptoms leads you to the right diagnosis. And certainly you should also deal with the symptoms, and sometimes we ask patients, what is your worst symptom, so that we can address that first, because that makes the patient feel better, that we are giving them the worst kind of, you know, what bothers you most, you know, so to speak. So we do need to do this kind of therapy, in my humble opinion. So what is therapy? Well, I mean, you look at colonial, anti-colonial struggles in history. As a scientist, that's what I do. I examine history. I show patient history. Patient history. Here we study the patient history. What happened? How it developed? What is then the best therapies for that kind of situation? So you try to deal with the etiology, with the underlying cause. And the underlying cause here of colonialism. So colonialism in the past, there's one of three possible outcomes for colonialism that stabilize the situation, let alone solve it, but at least stabilize it. One possible outcome is what happened in Australia and North America, if you want, where the natives are obliterated to such a stage that there are so few of them that you can afford to even apologize to them. In Australia, they now have a National Apology Day, where the Australian whites say, come to the remaining Aborigines and say, we're sorry, you know, we screwed you, we killed your ancestors, forgive us. And they genuinely mean it. I don't mean to mock this or anything. I think they mean it. But even if Australia decides tomorrow to give $1 million to each of the Aborigines who remain in Australia, the Australian budget would decrease by 0.1% for 1 year only or something. It is not a big deal, you know. This is one possible stabilizing effect of colonialism, anti-colonialism struggles, you know. And Native Americans still struggle here, by the way, here in Boston, by the way, and they go and have demonstrations on Columbus Day, you know, because they mourn Columbus Day. It's not a day of celebration for them. But anyways, that struggle continues, even though it's stabilized somewhat. The other possible scenario, if you want, is what happened in Algeria, where the white colonizers, in that case French people, packed their bags and went to Europe. I don't say went back to Europe, because actually some of them were like 5th, 6th, 7th generation in Algeria, because 130 years we're talking about, 140 years in Algeria. And they went to Europe. Some of them have never been to France, and they had to go. And at the cost of 1 million native lives, 1 million native Algerians died in the struggle. That's another possible outcome. Both of these outcomes are, I shouldn't maybe use the word impossible, because nothing in life is impossible, but very, very unlikely to happen in our situation in Palestine. What's the third possible scenario? The third possible scenario is similar to what happened in South Africa. Some form of a compromise where people live together in one country, right? This is the reality. What other option is there? Mutual genocide, maybe. That's also very unlikely. So, show me one instance in history of colonial, anti-colonial struggles that were solved via a two-state solution, so to speak. It doesn't happen. It cannot happen. It's impossible. Logistically, ideologically, we can talk more about that, but it's also detailed in my book, Sharing the Land of Canaan, which is available on my website, kumsiya.org. You can read it and understand. So, if what we are after is a better solution than solution one and solution two, if you want, then we have to go for solution three, which is some sort of accommodation within one country, right? And if that is what we aim for, how do we get there? Because I want the patient to return to health, so to speak. Health is, again, diversity. Health to me is diversity. Multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural society, that's healthy. Society. It's like in my garden, you know, I say in my garden, I love blue color, by the way, but I wouldn't want all my garden to be blue flowers, you know, that would be an ugly garden to me, that would not be a nice garden. So diversity, to go to the issue of diversity, how do we get there? And like any disease, and I keep using this analogy, the first and foremost method of therapy is from the inside out. It's the resistance from the people. The resistance from your body to the virus infection, for example. You get the white blood cells, B cells and T cells, attack that cancer cells or attack the virus or the bacteria and try to eliminate it. Sometimes you need help from outside. You get help from outside, vitamin C, whatever. drugs, but ultimately your body has to be the primary responsible for its treatment. And I think that's what happens also in human societies, is the primary responsibility for human societies is the resistance to the unjust situation that's created. And we Palestinians have had a long history of resistance. I won't go through detail on this. I wrote another book on this called Popular Resistance in Palestine, History of Hope and Empowerment, where I cite a few examples. Actually, I had to cut it down from 600 pages to 300 pages because the editor says only 300 pages can be printed in these books. So, but even when it was 600, it was one sentence on each event, because we're talking about 130-year history of resistance from the late Ottoman Empire period, where people like this resisted and led resistance and succeeded, by the way, in stopping Zionism in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And then the Zionists moved to Vienna, from Vienna to London, to work on the British Empire, and they got the Balfour Declaration from Britain and also France, by the way, the Jules Cambon Declaration, 1917. They got these two declarations from Britain and France during the First World War, and it was a quid pro quo that they got these two declarations. The quid pro quo was that if you promise us publicly that you will give us Palestine after the war, we will help you win the war. And how will help you win the war? By getting the United States into the war. The U.S. was isolationist then, did not really want to interfere in European wars, the First World War. The Zionists said, don't worry about it, we have people like Brandeis, you know, we have Brandeis University here, friends of the president, they can lobby and they can get the U.S. into the First World War. And in return, we just want a small piece of land called Palestine. So it's that's how it happened, by a large part, really. And Palestinians continued to resist when the British came and occupied Palestine to fulfill the Balfour Declaration. And these are Palestinian women who were demonstrating and going to meet with the British High Commissioner. For us Palestinians, of course, there are hundreds of forms of resistance. Going to school, like these girls are trying to go to school when the soldier prevents them from going to school, and then having it in the street is a form of resistance. You know, climbing walls, tearing down walls, drilling walls. Just last week they drilled holes through the wall. Resisting home demolitions, resisting uprooting of olive trees. These are all forms of resistance. And we also have other innovative forms of resistance, like, for example, the International Solidarity Movement, where I know some of you here, like Reins, had been with ISM. This was started in my village of Beit Sahur. I'm very proud of this. That started there in the tax revolt in Beit Sahur in 1988. And this has accelerated now, and tens of thousands of internationals have come to join us in the struggle, stand in front of bulldozers, etc. Even protected the Church of Nativity here. ISM people got onto the church when it was being shelled by the Israeli military, and managed to stop the shelling, actually. That's because Israel is usually more careful when there's internationals around. Not always, so I don't say it's 100% safe for you to come and join us. But usually when you're around, Israel is less violent than when you're not around. You know, this is Rachel Corey, who was killed when she was bulldozed to death in Rafah area. She came to my village where we trained her in nonviolent resistance for 2 days in Beit Sahur, before she decided to go to Rafah. Since I went back to Palestine in 2008, I lost, unfortunately, 16 and now 17, 3 days ago. I lost another colleague, friend of mine, whom I knew, in nonviolent resistance. 17 people so far that I have lost since I came back to Palestine that I knew personally. These are two of the people I knew personally who were killed. Basim Abu Rahman was killed when they shot a tear gas canister that crushed his chest. And when I went to pay respect to his family, I went to his funeral, but also I went a month later to his house, and his sister, Jawahir, on the right showed me his room, and they had left all his belongings exactly the way they were. But she herself was killed by inhaling tear gas in the same demonstration about 11 months later. This is me being arrested a few times, I actually, when I left Palestine, I felt very guilty. The first, you know, every time I travel, and I don't like to travel much. I was telling Rains also, I hate traveling. It's stressful on me, much more stressful, even though, of course, I have good food here and is able to move around except for the TSA harassing me, but nobody's checking my ID card at the entrance of Boston College, as Israel checks our ID cards. But I feel guilty being out of the country. I even miss the smell of tear gas, to be honest. For some reason, maybe I got addicted to it or something, I don't know. But this is real. I mean, it's very bizarre. But we were even arrested when we tried to ride the bus. We called it Palestine Freedom Riders. Because these are, we have segregated buses, of course. We have Israeli buses that take settlers from the settlements in Bethlehem or Ramallah or other places that are built on our land. And they take them to Jerusalem. They never check them. Whereas for me, I'm not allowed to go to Jerusalem. So we try to show and highlight this discrimination, this racism in the system of transportation there.
That was a portion of Professor Mazen Kumsaya's address at Boston College, to be continued in a future broadcast, where he describes his work in developing a natural history museum in Bethlehem and how that relates to the resistance. But we have to say goodbye for today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.